Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, June 12th, 2015. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. And this week, my experts selecting those stories are Jeff Neal of ICF International. It's great to see you, my friend. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I always love to be in the studio with you.
And same here. And I'm glad you're here. And also joining me today is Dan Mintz. And you have to give me two sentences quickly about your gig at the University of Maryland University College now. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you. I'm the program chair for the Information Systems Management major, which has about 8,200 students that go through it each year. And it's a blast.
That's a terrific deal, and congratulations on that, and I'm glad that you're here. Each of you has chosen what you think are the three most important federal news stories of the week and have ranked them in order from number three to number one, and we start where we always do with...
Number three!
And Jeff Neal, your choice at number three is from federalnewsradio.com, my colleague Jared Serbu's story. Pentagon's new HR chief says personnel systems in urgent need of reform. And as Jared reported this story, and I read both his remarks on our website and listened to the report on the radio, hearing from Brad Carson, acting Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, also serving as Undersecretary of the Army, with all due respect to Mr. Carson, who I think a lot of and is very highly regarded, my response was, you think so? And it appears, though, that he's very serious about making changes in the next 18 months.
I think he is. And when you look at the personnel system for the military, there are some significant problems with it. When you look at the DoD budget, a huge part of it is pay for military members, pay for civilian employees, benefits for both, and then retirement for the military. And if something isn't done to the system, the manpower, person power, I guess, is the more politically correct way, the manpower requirements and budget are going to continue to grow to the point where it crowds out everything else. I think that's important because when you look at trying to save some money in defense, and believe it or not, there are some people who'd like to save money in defense, when you ask them what you should cut, you ask about weapon systems, no. Military installations, no. Personnel cost, no. There's nothing they can come up with. You know, they could probably all agree that you should stop spending money to plant flowers in front of military bases, and that's about it. And this one is a very sizable expense. I think what they've come up with is a good proposal that doesn't do anything to harm current military members or to change the contract that was made with them when they enlisted. So it's a very balanced and fair approach that I think is going to get some traction. And so that's significant. Anything that affects the military, given that we wouldn't have a free country if it wasn't for our military, is really important and newsworthy.
I think that concept is probably the most important, too, that they're not going to do anything to impact the people who serve now. And I think that will bode well for employees all across government for the future, because that seems to be the biggest point of uncertainty for people in the civilian agencies right now, is what's going to happen to me. And if somehow that could be codified in whatever is going is going to be done about employee benefits and pay moving forward, I think you'd let everybody that serves now breathe a sigh of relief and kind of be able to feel more free to start making logical decisions instead of, I've got to do this or that tomorrow because they might do something that I don't like.
I think that's spot on. And I think if you look at the federal government as an employer, both for the military and civilians, there are many criticisms you can make of the government. One thing that they haven't had a history of doing, and this doesn't show any tendency to do it either, is they haven't gone in and changed the rules on people who are already there. And this one, they're not going to do that. I think that's a great thing to do. Anything that would break that contract with the current military members would be a non-starter, I think, in virtually everybody's book.
Jared has a number of interesting quotes from Secretary Carson in this piece, but here's the one that jumped out at me, Jeff. A lot of people say 18 months isn't enough time to make these changes, but that's an indictment of our system. 3 months ought to be enough time to at least prototype a new personnel system. That, to me, says two different things. One, he's serious about doing something and serious about action. And the other thing is, he appears to be willing to take on the way things work and not just try to, well, let's see what framework we can lay over top of what we already have now.
One of the biggest tools of the bureaucrat is we don't have enough time.
Mm-hmm.
It will take so much longer than you've got to do this. And that's just a bureaucratic maneuver. You can do a lot of things in 18 months.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Jeff Neal, is from federalnewsradio.com. Pentagon's new HR chief says personnel systems in urgent need of reform. Dan Mintz, your choice at number three is from GCN, and the headline is Five Trends That Will Shape Government IT Strategy. And I note the word strategy in the headline because it seems to me, as I look at this list, thinking about IT strategically is just as important as thinking about the technology piece of it.
Yeah, strategy is going to drive behavior. And one of the things that's interesting, the article has five. We're not going to go through all five and links to it. A bigger article has 10. But a number of the activities, which like the increasing emphasis on having an all-digital workforce, the emphasis on having open data, the issue in terms of doing analytics on data, are all happening. And in some ways become more difficult because of some of the articles we'll talk later because of all these security issues and things like that that cause people to want to emotionally go in the opposite direction. So government is faced with this conflict between technology is driving them in one direction and a lot of the oversight issues are driving them in an opposite direction.
There are a couple of things on this list that seem to me to be maybe overly optimistic as far as the federal government is concerned. And this is reporting on a Gartner list of 10 most important technology trends in digital government. I know that there are some state, local jurisdictions that are having a fair amount of success with digital government. The one that it strikes me might be the toughest for the federal government to crack is the one on multi-channel citizen engagement. And it actually ties into another one here, citizen electronic ID. The federal government, I think for very good reason, wants to make sure as they move out on digital government that the people that they're interacting with are really the people they're interacting with.
Yeah, so you have two issues there. The first, the interesting thing you mentioned that, and in fact, this would be interesting for providers of services to government in general, state governments and local governments often have the least amount of human capital resources. As much as the federal government complains, the talent is very thin when you get to the state and local government.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at the local government, which really touches citizens, where the need of dealing with the citizen can drive change. So you find a lot of the stat databases and the online interface is often done more robustly at the local and state level than the federal level. And so therefore providers actually may start looking to the state governments and local governments for opportunities to have impact. The second is you're right. I mean, electronic IDs, if you call something an electronic ID, you're immediately going to hit into enormous policy and public relations problems. Yet, things that are sort of like electronic IDs are used all the time in terms of identifying for electronic benefits and things like that. So you have that dichotomy going on all the time.
There's a term here on this list that I was not familiar with, edge analytics, but I imagine it's something I'm going to hear a lot more about in the coming year, 2 years, 5 years.
So the issue we have is governments and organizations in general are interfacing more and more to their customer base and stakeholders on the edge of their networks. So what happens here is you want to measure how effective that is and how active that is and what are the results of that. So first of all, there's two issues there. One is you're having increasing activity around data analytics and government analytics. And the second thing is you have to deal with it on the edge of your architecture. And that's new, but it's very rapid. It's happening more and more.
Dan Mintz's choice at number three, the third most important federal news story of the week, is from GCN. It is headline Five Trends That Will Shape Government IT Strategy, and you can read it and all of our countdown selections today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dan Mintz and Jeff Neal, back in a moment on the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Jeff Neal and Dan Mintz, and we are up to
number two.
And I told you, gentlemen, before we started the program, that today is a case of great minds think alike, because, Dan, your choice at number two is from FCW. The headline is, How Flexible Should Fatara Be? And, Jeff, your choice at number two is, OMB Finalizes Fatara Guidance. That's from the Federal Times. The final guidance is out, and we know a lot about it that will impact people a lot of different ways. I'll start with you, Dan. What about the Fatara guidance and the information in this story is significant to you as a former CIO?
So on a, there's both positive, I'll call it positive, negative, and then neutral comments, but I'll talk about the positive here and we'll see how the conversation goes.
Okay.
So at least to me, there's three things that are positive about it and have positive potential. One thing is it attempts to do some clarification of the roles of these various C-level government responsibilities, even though it doesn't, you know, go 100%, but it clarifies some of them and defines. The second thing is, and specifically, it defines a little bit more thoroughly the role of the CIO in terms of all this activity. And as I think will come in the conversation, still complexity about that. But that second thing that is saying this is where the CIO touches the process, at least sets some markers that people will have to pay attention to. And the third is it's encouraging, at least on the surface, a greater orientation toward transparency of result. That is, it's requiring information to be provided in the public space in some fashion about the results of a lot of this activity. And like anything else, I think the more you can make performance information open and available, it will help improve behavior.
So you said positive potential. What has to happen to make sure that potential is realized? Because if, you know, we're still sitting here, what, almost 20 years after Klinger-Cohen, and some of that stuff's never been touched.
Yeah, well, and I suspect we'll be here 20 years from now, and there will be some parts of this that will never have been touched either. It's the nature of the business. I think, first of all, you're going to find that different agencies are going to do a better or worse job depending on the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
There will be people who themselves are more focused or more competent or more strong as individuals. They'll do a better job. They'll have stronger relationships with the top leadership in their agency or department to accomplish something. People who have developed strong relationships with the CFO community, you know, a CIO who has a strong relationship with the CFO is far more likely to be able to implement some of these, because these two functions represent different authority levels. And when they're cooperative, it can be very effective. When they're not cooperative, it's not effective.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly one thing that'll be there. I will say my advice in general is to try and, as they say, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. I think people have to decide what they're going to focus on and get some of it right, rather than trying to do everything at once and therefore not accomplishing anything.
And that's not really something that government's always good at, is it? Deciding priorities, Jeff, sticking to those priorities until they're completed, and then being satisfied to go back and establish new priorities.
Government has lots of priorities. It's just that everybody has their own, and they don't seem to talk about them enough.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Fatara story was important for a couple of reasons. One of them, and this is, you can tell I'm a Washington person when I say this, one of them is the process that OMB used to develop this guidance.
Mm-hmm.
OMB recognized the lesson of Klinger-Cohen, and that's that you can have a law that says some good things, and if you implement it in a very ineffective way, very little happens as a result. The guidance that came out after Klinger-Cohen was basically in the form of suggestions. It was, you should do this. You ought to do that. Here's a model for how things could be done. When this one came around, they started going out and talking to people, and they went out and talked to the CIO Council. They talked to individuals. They talked to the President's Management Council. They talked to a lot of different people. One group they talked to was a group of people assembled by the Partnership for Public Service. It was a group of current and former CXOs, CIOs, CHICOs, CFOs, and Chief Procurement Officers. And I was fortunate enough to be one of the folks who was involved in those discussions. And we spent 4 or 5 evenings for 2 or 3 hours at a time sitting down with OMB talking about what could go wrong with Fatara and would be, what would work in guidance and what wouldn't work in guidance. And it was very clear they wanted this thing to actually work. Mm-hmm. They wanted to see substantial differences in government, how government buys IT, how the role of CIOs in government. And so we advised them on what could happen and how you can avoid letting people tear it apart. And what they came up with, I thought, was extremely well thought out guidance. It addresses the human capital issues. It addresses procurement issues. It addresses the role of the CIO relative to the heads of IT in bureaus and components and agencies within a department. It addressed all of that with an eye toward how can somebody make this not work, because we knew that would happen. Mm-hmm. And I think what they came up with from a process perspective was a model for how public policy could be developed. I think they did a super job on that. The other thing that I thought was really important about this is when you look at how much money goes into federal IT and how haphazardly in some departments and agencies it's spent, I think this will help get a handle on it. I'll give you an example. At DHS, we had about a dozen different learning management systems from three or four different companies. We found that we could consolidate those into one or two learning management systems and save over $5 million a year. That's on one HR system. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're looking at here is something that should fundamentally change the role of a CIO. It allows a CIO to have a look into the components and the bureaus and the sub-agencies, into what they're doing on IT, and to be able to stop things that shouldn't go forward, where they're just throwing away money. Now, the thing we have to watch is to see what's going to happen, and you know darn well that's going to happen. People are going to start running to the Hill now, mm-hmm. and saying, well, we need to get out of FITARA free card.
It's already started.
It absolutely has, mm-hmm. and it will. And the same people that wanted FITARA on the Hill might very well respond to a constituent and say, well, you know, we can give you a free pass and everybody else has to comply. Mm-hmm. When they start breaking people out of FITARA, they'll break FITARA. Mm-hmm. So they really need to be disciplined about not letting people get out of FITARA free card.
Are you surprised that it's happened as quickly as it has, that people have started to try to get out of it, Dan?
No, I think on the negative side of this, there's two or three things that are going to have to be overcome, or at least will impede. First of all, the appropriations process at the end of the day has different things that push it than good, coherent management. And those forces are get in the way. I mean, you know, we talk in a different place where one of the problems with managing DHS, and in addition to the management issues, is the multiplicity of committees that have responsibility for interfacing to DHS. Well, the same thing problem here you have is the appropriation process doesn't work well because they want to control their piece. So that's one problem. The second problem, which the measurements may help overcome, is the fact is that one of the reasons commercial implementations of things like this work is because the executives of an organization can tie it to the defined mission of the organization. Well, you know, when I worked at the Department of Transportation, I used to joke about it being called the Federation of Transportation. And it's a relatively coherent department. Mm-hmm. These departments are combinations of disparate agencies, many of whom have goals that are not tightly coupled and not well-defined. So therefore, the lever of saying we're going to do this good thing because it ties to this mission becomes a very complex a discussion. Mm-hmm. And the final piece, going back to what Jeff mentioned about the multiple systems at DHS, I still think, and I've said for a long time, that for some of these issues, the government needs to move away from a notional idea of shared services, whether it's within a department or across the government. And right now, it's at best a notion. And if they really want to solve some of these things, they're going to have to eventually get to empowering it and doing it for real.
Mm-hmm. The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by both Dan Mintz and Jeff Neal, is the FITARA guidance from the Office of Management and Budget. Jeff's choice at number two is from the Federal Times. OMB finalizes FITARA guidance. Dan's choice is from FCW. How flexible should FITARA be? Both of those stories and all of this week's countdown stories are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week. And it's a huge controversy. I'm sure that people just can't even begin to imagine what the number one choice might be. We'll reveal it next on In Depth with Francis Rose. That's sarcasm, everybody. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Dan Mintz and Jeff Neal, and the Great Minds Think Alike edition continues.
Number one.
You've both chosen, shockingly enough, the most important federal news story of the week, data breach at the Office of Personnel Management and the continued fallout of that data breach. Jeff, you chose a story from federalnewsradio.com that my colleague Michael O'Connell wrote, Union Presses OPM on Lack of Transparency About Data Breach. And Dan, you chose Jason Miller's story, headlined Senators Press for Answers and More Funding for OPM After the Data Breach. I want to start at the transparency piece of this, Jeff, because this is the part of it that both personally and as a journalist I've found the most troubling. Story after story after story, OPM declined to comment. OPM declined to comment. People are writing to us completely out of the blue and saying, what's going on? We don't know what's going on. We got a forwarded email on Tuesday, I think it was, from a former chief information officer in the government who had forwarded an email that a friend of his had sent him that they'd received from CSID, and they couldn't tell if it was real or not because it looked like a fishing expedition email. It was constructed in the same way. Now, there wasn't poor grammar or any of the characteristics that you typically see, but the method of delivery was not the greatest, it didn't seem. And you said earlier, and I think you said correctly, some of the things OPM, off the air, you said some of the things OPM is getting hammered for are not fair. But there are a number of things that they are getting hammered for that I think it is fair. And this lack of transparency and the difficulty communicating information to the employees themselves, I think in this particular case, in the story that you cited, that AFGE has very good reason to be troubled about.
The transparency issue is one that I think is a huge concern. That, you know, this administration prides itself on being very transparent, and I think in a lot of ways has been remarkably transparent over the last 6 years. In this case, as somebody whose information may have been compromised because I'm a federal retiree, I would like to know what they got into. And I think every federal employee wants to know, and every journalist wants to know, and every retiree wants to know. And they have known about this apparently since April. So they've had a couple of months to think about how to respond to it. One side of me says, okay, there may be reasons they don't want to disclose what was broken into because they're still trying to do some sort of forensic analysis and they don't want to start talking about what it is. But that makes more sense if you're talking about something that you don't want a bad guy to know, you know, what you're doing. The bad guys know what database they got into because they got into it. Or databases. They know what they got into. And I think it's troubling people because they don't seem to be talking about what it was. And when you start looking at what it is, I think most people are assuming that it's something called the Enterprise Human Resources Integration Data, which is, it used to be called the Central Personnel Data File, but back in 2010, they changed the name of it. And EHRI has a lot of data about every federal employee. It has your name, your social security number, your date of birth, your address. It has your security clearance. It has what your job is. It has what kind of health insurance you have, what kind of life insurance you have. If you do cybersecurity work, there's a field where there are like 40 different codes that outline what kind of cybersecurity work you do, which would allow somebody to track down everybody in the federal government who does cybersecurity. So if you wanted to target people by occupation, you could do that. So that I think is very troubling. And people, as soon as security reasons allow you to communicate what was broken into, the government needs to do that. There may be a security reason that is keeping them from doing that right now. And I would assume at this point OPM is no longer in control of what they can and can't release. I would assume the White House, the FBI, National Security Agency, folks like that are going to be dictating what OPM can release. So if you want to beat on somebody for it, I probably wouldn't beat on OPM because mm-hmm. I don't think they're in control of what they can release right now. But it is troubling. And when you look at this data, the other thing you can do is, you know, there are a great many occupations in government where the number of people who do the work is classified. If you have access to all of this information, you can go in and see exactly how many people are doing that type of work. So there are lots of types of big data analyses that people could do on this massive store of data. And the sooner people know what was broken into, the better off I think we'll be.
Dan, your story, the Jason Miller story, your selection at number one, contains one passage that I think would drive just about anybody crazy that read it, whose information might be contained here. OPM's challenges with cybersecurity are well documented. Its inspector general repeatedly found in November 2014, this is before even the breach happened as far as the timeline that we've been told so far, that the agency had regressed in some IT security areas.
Yeah, one of the problems, and this comes back a little bit to the shared services kind of activity, one of the challenges you have is that large organizations tend to do only a small number of things very well. And most of the things they're going to do well relate very directly to mission. And agencies whose primary, now obviously protecting the data was very important, is obviously very important. But the primary mission is collecting, you know, HR resources and or data and doing HR policy and things like that. And the organizations in the government that are particularly adept at security are organizations like DOD, organizations like DHS, and others like that. So what happens is the civilian agencies often stumble. I mean, and that's not unique to OPM. That's true in a lot of places. I remember there was a security briefing when there was a big problem when I, again, was at DOT, and they DHS and DOD held a briefing and in a SCIF, and the only people who were allowed into the SCIF were people with TSSCI clearances. Well, I was one of the very few civilian CIOs who had that clearance. So the people they had to talk to couldn't even come to the briefing. So what you have is a problem of expertise. I would suggest that we need to look to other agencies that are better at security. But yeah, no, this is a continuing problem.
Is it possible that this might start a trend toward individual agencies becoming less responsible or having less autonomy for their own cybersecurity and have it become more of a government-wide? I mean, I guess if you're going to do something as a shared service, this is a pretty important shared service.
Well, shared services, as I said, there's no evidence to me that kind of thing is worked well. But I think my personal opinion is we need to, or the government needs to think about that. I think there are two other issues that come out of this. One, I'll just talk about the transparency part. We have a dichotomy, and let me do beyond this administration, just on the one part of it. We are definitely moving in terms of opening project data on a day-to-day basis. Open APIs and things like that allow that data to come out. But policy complications or problems, the political process that elects people tends to tightly control the flow of information. So whenever we've had those kinds of breaches or problems, you know, like healthcare.com and other kinds of things, people clam up. The political people tend to really limit it. And as Jeff said, again, if you're going to blame somebody for the lack of transparency, it's probably not at OPM. But that's very natural, and I don't see that changing at all. The other thing is, you find that when big problems happen, one of the things that isn't done well is relates to that is the management of the crises. There's the, telling the story correctly, providing context, explaining what's going to happen. People don't do that very well across the government. And it's often the lack of the coherent story that makes the crises worse. And we have lots of examples of that over the last series of years, not just this administration, but other administrations.
And that's the issue that I, from what I am hearing from them, is driving the employees crazy, is they don't know what's going on. And the hackers actually have more knowledge of what was stolen than the employees whose information was stolen. That's got to be maddening.
Well, at this point, I would guess the hackers have more information about what's going on than anybody in our government mm-hmm. does, because they may still be trying to identify how far this went and how much data was exfiltrated. So I think they probably know a lot more than anybody in our government knows.
But we're at a point in this, though, where I don't think you can over-communicate, can you?
You probably can over-communicate. You can, if you start inadvertently disclosing information that helps people do more hacks like this, that could create a problem. I mean, any communication about this is going to need to be very carefully vetted. It's going to need legal folks to look at it. It's going to need IT folks to look at it. It's going to need very capable security experts to look at it and say, okay, you can say this.
Mm-hmm.
And they have had a lot of time to vet that since this was apparently discovered 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had time to vet that. But that's something that needs to happen. I think right now, I mean, I talked to a retiree yesterday who was extremely worried and saying, well, should I go out and buy credit monitoring on my own? And should I do a variety of other things to protect myself? And I think that's causing people to get scared. And it's just one more thing that's going to hurt federal employee morale. They really do need to know what they need to do to protect themselves. They need to know what about them was taken, so they can be aware of that. But it's I don't know, I understand where OPM is coming from and where the administration is coming from on wanting to be careful about what they share, but I also understand why the employees are concerned, why AFGE is speaking up so forcefully about this, because it's a very big deal. We're told all the time, don't let people see a password. Don't use the same password over and over again. Don't do this, don't do that. And now we find out our home address, name, social security number, all this stuff is probably in somebody's hands. And we don't know what that somebody wants to do with it. If it's China, they might have a very different set of goals than some criminal organization would have. But it's something that's scaring people a lot. And we need to do what we can to reassure people and to help them be vigilant, so to the degree they can protect themselves.
I have two. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say there's always a dichotomy with these things. On one hand, if you want to be transparent, you run the risk of not always being correct.
Mm-hmm.
So you run the problem that you may say something that turns out not to be 100% accurate, which has its own price.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you try and wait till you get the story exactly straight, you end up often doing nothing mm-hmm. because you never get the story straight. And that's the dilemma. There's no winning position.
There's two thoughts I want to pursue about what each of you have said when we come back. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by both Jeff Neal and Dan Mintz, is the breach of data at the Office of Personnel Management and the fallout and responses on that, when we continue some more on OPM's data breach on In Depth with Francis Rose. It's the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features this week the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Jeff Neal and Dan Mintz, and the most important story is chosen by both. is the fallout, reaction, and response to the data breach at the Office of Personnel Management. Jeff chose as his most important story of the week my colleague Mike O'Connell's story, Union Presses OPM on Lack of Transparency About the Data Breach. And Dan chose Jason Miller's story, Senators Press for Answers and More Funding for OPM After the Data Breach. And both of those are from federalnewsradio.com. I mentioned before the break I had 2 points I wanted to pursue. One of those is almost uniformly, pretty much everybody from Thursday eve, last Thursday when we first learned about this on, everybody who knows, who's a cyber person, that's their field, said this appears at least to be an espionage play and not an identity theft play. Now, I certainly understand why OPM provided identity theft resources and information to their employees on the one hand. On the other hand, Jeff, I fear that it feeds that unhappiness, fear, skepticism that you talked to just toward the end of our last break about not knowing what's going on and not knowing what to do next and not knowing how this is really affecting the, each individual person and what it will do to them.
It probably could, but if... Let's assume that this is an espionage attempt and that the Chinese government has all this information. That doesn't mean that they might not, just for mischief-making purposes, dump a bunch of it to criminals who will do things like identity theft. So there's no guarantee that if it's a government, if it's a state actor, China or anybody else, that they won't use it for purposes other than their state purposes. So I think it makes sense. Frankly, I would go so far as to say that because the federal government is going to maintain all of this information on its people, because it has to, there's no way it can employ 2 million people without maintaining the information, we need to start treating this information as what it is, which is mission-critical information. HR information is mission-critical. Start treating it that way. And frankly, I would say give every federal employee credit monitoring as part of their employment agreement with the government, because you know that people are going to continue to try to get into government systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that would provide some small degree of comfort for a lot of federal employees. I mean, the biggest thing people are worried about is someone is going to go out and, you know, and start getting loans in my name and create massive problems and ruin me financially.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways you can mitigate that risk, and credit monitoring is a way to do it. It's not 100% effective, but at least it's something that they can do. So if you did that, and if you gave people much better training on what they can personally do to protect themselves, because most agencies are giving people a few minutes a year of security training, IT security training. Give them something much more substantive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would go a long way toward reassuring people, and they would see that their employer does care about what happens to their personal information that the employer is keeping.
And I don't want it to sound like I thought treating this as an identity theft play only was harmful, or that they shouldn't have provided those resources. Of course they should have provided those resources. I had not thought of your suggestion about providing credit monitoring and so on as a benefit, but that's certainly something I think that's a good idea and worth consideration. It just struck me that it was treated as an identity theft play, almost kind of the de facto, this is how we respond to this, so this is what we're going to do, without much of a consideration of what it really meant for the employees on a much deeper level. I didn't ever hear any conjecture about anything else coming from the way that OPM was responding to it, as if to say, it's possible this could be this, it's possible it could be another reason, but we're going to provide you these resources as part of that. And I think that just feeds the lack of clarity. The other issue that I think, Dan, might be more up your alley is we have seen the government time after time after time tell the private sector, when you're breached, you need to be much more forthcoming, and you need to share information much more rapidly, and you need to share that information without fear of judgment. And we all need to understand what's going on. They learned this happened in December. They learned about it in April and disclosed the first week of June. Does that shoot the government's credibility as far as being able to go to the private sector and say you should be forthcoming and share information?
Well, the answer is no one is very good at sharing information. You know, when I when I was at DOT, that was right when the veterans, there was a huge release of the veterans data. And one of the things when I looked at the IG report was the time it took to get from the incident to the secretary at Veterans was months and months and months. And there were all these bureaucratic reasons and political reasons and fear reasons and anger reasons. So, yes, of course it does. It hurts credibility a great deal.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by both my guests on the Federal News Countdown, Jeff Neal and Dan Mintz, the data breach at the Office of Personnel Management. And you can find all the stories that each of them selected, not just that number one, but all through the countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Thank you very much, as always, gentlemen. Dan Mintz, great to see you as always.
Great to be here.
And Jeff Neal, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me. I always like to be here.
And we love having you. And the Federal News Countdown is archived on federalnewsradio.com. You can listen whenever you want. And the Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose.